Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free. And catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. We're in, we're out. We have a deal on the debt ceiling. We don't. There are crazy senators saying, well, the only way we'll let this go is if we defund vaccinating people. Crazy, crazy times. And look, leave it to the Republicans to never let a good crisis go to waste when they want to push their ideology. And you got today, you know, Mike Lee, who's way out there, Ted Cruz, who go back to Cancun already, and Roger Marshall of Kansas saying, well, you know, we'll let that little debt ceiling thing go if you just defund the vaccine mandate. If you defund the thing that, you know, is going to help us get through this little pandemic thing. And look, Pelosi is right. You know, when she was asked, you know, what's the Democratic message out of this? And you go, I got to be honest, if you're sitting asking those questions, someone should smack you. And she was right. She goes, you know, how do Republicans explain to the public that they're shutting down the government because they don't want people to get vaccinated? And that is the right question. But here's the answer. Their supporters don't care. Their supporters want to shut the government down. Their supporters don't want people to get vaccinated. Their supporters want the economy to fail and there to be chaos. Why? Well, because they have this imaginary dream that the former guy and JFK Jr., I guess they're still pulling that, somehow, magically, going to be reinstalled. Wow. How'd these people get out of grade school? Now, here's the good thing. Mitch McConnell, who, honestly and truthfully, I'm sure, loves playing the Grinch. He said there's going to be no shutdown, probably because, you know, he really ate it the last time. The last shutdown, you know, people put on him. And I don't think he wants to be blamed again just before Christmas when the economy's kind of doing well. And it would give Biden the ability to go, well, if things are bad, it's because they shut everything down. But understand, these are people, quite frankly, who would burn the house down with people inside and be gleeful that it all went up in smoke. Just to push their ideology. And this is the sad place we're in. You know, I had a conversation with somebody today who said, you know, when was the last time a Republican came forth with an idea? When was there something that came forth to solve a problem? When did they actually do something for the working class of this country? Can you name one thing, one proposal, one idea, one piece of legislation that said, you know, we're going to do this for the betterment of the working class? We are going to help working families. Now, they've got their ideology, and I threw out a couple things. Well, they would argue tax cuts for the rich might trickle down, maybe, possibly, could maybe be a raise in your paycheck, to which the person quickly shut that down, going, no, that hasn't happened. That was the myth. That was the fantasy. You know, trickle down was supposed to benefit everyone because, you know, we would give all the money to the rich people and it would flow downward like rivers of gold and honey. And it would be wonderful. Rich people would get richer. The working people would get richer too. And it'd be great. We would all share in prosperity. And they sold us this kumbaya nonsense. And some of us bought it. Far too many. All the while, what they were doing is they were breaking up unions. They were doing things to make it harder for people to join and form unions to demand some of that gold and honey. And they ended up, you know, going, we're going to cut taxes. And they trained a working class to think, hey, you're someday going to be a millionaire. So you don't want to tax them too much because you could be there someday, while kicking the ladder off the side of the building. And here we are in a moment, fighting over a debt ceiling that is ridiculous. As anyone knows, you sit around the kitchen table, the time that you argue about money is before you spend it. If you don't have it, that's the time you argue over it. Now, you've already spent the money. This is the thing about the debt ceiling that drives me nuts. This is simply saying we're going to pay our bills. This is the wealthiest country on the planet, the wealthiest country in the history of civilization, at its wealthiest moment, going, you know what, maybe we're not going to pay our bills this month. And maybe we're going to throw the entire economy into chaos and the globe into chaos. Because guess what? The world's reserved currency is the dollar, and everybody has dollars and everybody wants to get their bills paid. Because guess what? All of the currents, all of the economic activity on the globe, done in dollars, until we booger this up. Because at some point, the rest of the world's got to look to us and go, you know, this is just ridiculous that we've given you this kind of power. Now, the debt ceiling is an artificial construct. It's ridiculous. It is stupid. But it's one of those nice tools that Republicans use every time a Democratic president is in power so that they can extract their pound of flesh. You may remember back during the Obama years, they got their screwquester through, which was an across-the-board cut in everything. Didn't matter what it was. And some argue that's what led to what happened in Benghazi, because we went and we cut too much. But no, you'll never get that out of the Republicans. So here's where we are, from what I understand. Maybe it's going to pass. Maybe we're going to get through the debt ceiling. Maybe McConnell will get it through. Maybe by Friday, maybe not. And then what happens? I'm sure they'll pass a continuing resolution to go to the next day or the next day. But this is not the way you run a lemonade stand, let alone the most powerful nation in the world. And it shows that the people who are in those halls of power need to go. If in this moment you're against raising the debt ceiling to pay our bills, you should leave. You should be sent the door. But where this conversation went with this person I was talking to is going, like, you know, what are they getting done? Because, you know, this person was saying that, you know, there's a lot of things in his life that they need. A lot of stuff in the Build Back Better plan. You know, money for kids to go to school. You know, the college stuff that was in there. Because you may remember originally, free community college was in the Build Back Better plan. And it's something I've advocated for. I've said, look, we need to have an additional 2 years. 100 years ago, we decided that an eighth grade education wasn't enough, needed to go through high school. I'm now saying you need those extra 2 years. Could be community college to get an associate's degree, or more likely and better, get people into apprenticeship programs, learn a trade, a skill, and be able to have the ability to, you know, to add to our economy. with the kind of training instead of going deep into hock. And one of the things that I came across today that just sent me just flipping, and I've heard these stories hundreds of times. None of this is new. This person was saying, you know, I sure hope they do something on debt forgiveness. Because he was saying, you know, I'm thousands of dollars in debt. You know, I got my degree years ago. And, you know, this whole thing. And the story that he told was, look, there were a couple of times where I wasn't able to pay because I lost my job. You go through all of these crises. They don't give you any forgiveness. There's no, oh, you're okay. Except this last time. Thank you, Joe Biden. He's going, you know, every time I had to stop, it came with penalties and fees and all kinds of stuff. And someone sent me a tweet that was out today on someone's student loan situation. And it said the original amount that was disbursed when this person went to college was $72,879, which is a ton of money. I don't know what kind of degree. I hope you got a really good degree for that kind of money. But I was also told, look, you can go to some state schools and run that up. Going to some state schools here in Pennsylvania and across the country, which again, wasn't that way years ago. It said that the amount that this person paid to the student loan company over these all these years, including interest, fees, all kinds of stuff, $96,000. So they more than paid back the student loan, more than paid it back with interest. And the remaining balance, and this is the part that just sent me going, what? The remaining balance was still $168,000. And you go, hold on, wait a second, how do you get here? And as this person was, you know, walking me through, they're going, look, every time you stop, it comes with, fees for this and that and penalties. And every time you don't pay, there's, you know, compounded this and added that. And it's a huge scam. And this is something that, you know, millions of people in this country are saddled with. When you look at the fact that we've well passed $1 trillion in student loan debt in this country, you wonder why a generation, two generations now, are screaming for some help. And I've said from the beginning, we should not have profiteers doing anything with student loans. Nothing. I believe that it's an investment in our society. I believe it's for the common good of our country. And it's something that we should be, if not heavily subsidizing, as we did in past generations. If you're one of the baby boomers, you got a great deal going to college. I'm looking at this and I'm going, at the bare minimum, we should say, you know what? You take out a student loan, you pay it back. No interest, no fees, no penalties. You pay back what you borrowed. To me, that's fairness. Now, this person that they sent me this thing paid back their money in excess. They should be done. But the reality is there's still $168,000. You go, how is that possible? How is it even remotely possible? And it's how the game is rigged. It's how when you get into debt, especially when you're talking about loan sharks and payday lenders, you never get out. Once they got you, they got you. And it's things like this that need to get done. And I got to tell you, I'm hoping Joe Biden does something, through executive order, because clearly no Republican's going to get on board with this. But if you want to talk about family values, if you want to talk about how we help people, this is one area that would help families. This is one area, if you want to talk about, hey, we want people to start families. This is one area that would just be a boom for our economy. And look, I'm not advocating wiping out the debt and saying you don't have to owe it back. I'm saying you pay back what you borrowed. Maybe 1% interest, maybe 2 at most, because ultimately this is for the common good. This is for the health of our country, the health of our economy. And if we're going to be competitive around the globe, we certainly want people who are, well, somewhat educated, because I look around and I'm going, you know, with all the high school graduates who are now virologists and epidemiologists, we need to do something. Maybe some remedial classes, I don't know. But it seems to me we can be doing a lot better than, well, we're on the brink of shutting our government down. We're on the brink of causing economic chaos. We're on the brink of causing global economic chaos in a globe that is already struggling. Because while we're hearing it and complaining about, oh, the inflation rate is so high here in the U.S. Oh, my goodness, inflation's so high. It's higher around the world. I know we like to think we're special and we're the only ones that are affected by this, but everywhere else is experienced the same thing. And for me, the idea that we have this kind of gridlock and a political party who doesn't seem to want to get anything done is just, well, it's mind-blowing to me. It's one of those things where you just, I never thought I would be in this place. But, you know, this person I was talking to was saying, look, you know, he was going through the number of legislators going, you know, what has this person done? What has this person done? Nothing. All they've done is they've caused enough noise to be able to stand up and say, hey, look at me. Everyone's attacking me. So that must mean that I'm fighting for you. You know, I think back years ago, and I'm old enough to remember when earmarks and pork barrel spending were possible, and the Congress people would come back and go, hey, look what we brought back. Look at what we did in the community. Look at the bridges we rebuilt. Look at the museums we had built. Look at the money we brought back for schools and hospitals and whatever. Look at what we did. We paved the road out in front of your house so you don't have to worry about your car's front end alignment for at least another 6 months. Thank you. We don't do that anymore. What we've got now are little reality stars who just want attention. The fact that Lauren Boebert is in Congress is a national disgrace. The fact that Marjorie Taylor Greene is in Congress is a national disgrace. The fact that someone like Paul Gosar is in Congress is a national disgrace. Louis Gohmert, Matt Gaetz, you can go down the list. The fact that these people are taking up space in our House of Representatives is a national disgrace. You know, there used to be Republicans. There used to be. And this is where I reach out to my Republican friends and go, look, there used to be good, decent Republicans who said, yeah, we want to pave the roads and bridges. Yeah, we want to bring opportunities back to our communities. Yeah, we're going to stand with working people and push for prevailing wage so you don't get cheated on the job. And we're going to push for union rights so you have the right to collectively bargain. And we're going to push for, you know, you to get health care in those jobs. We're going to push to make lives better. Instead of just being the party of no and the party of destruction and the, well, you know, look, the party of reality TV. This is all we're getting. And we deserve better. As a nation, we deserve so much better than the chaos and the nonsense you see going on every day. And it's a reality show. Now, the other day we had former Alabama Senator Doug Jones on. He said, well, you know, they talk a lot more and there's a lot more bipartisanship. You just don't see it. And that's the problem. If it is going on, and I don't not believe Senator Jones. But if that truly was going on behind doors, they better start doing it in public. Because guess what? It's filtering down to we the people, to where you can't have a reasonable conversation with somebody that you disagree with anymore. There's no more debate. There's no more discussion. There's no more, hey, how do we get the roads paved? How do we make an opportunity for our kids to get an early childhood education, a good start? How do we make sure that, hey, I've yet to meet anybody who says, yeah, another 2 years of schooling wouldn't be a bad idea. I've yet to meet anyone. No, absolutely not. I'm against it. I haven't met those people. When you start saying, yeah, we should get them some job training, get them an extra couple of years to and not be saddled with a lifetime of debt. These programs are popular. But what do our friends on the Republican side do? Nothing. And look, I'm not giving Democrats a pass either. You still got Manchin and Sinema and a couple others who have been holding things back. But in this moment, we got to get things done. And we got to get things done really quickly. Really quickly. Anyway, lots to get to, lots to talk about today. I also want to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. When we come back, Matias Fernango is going to be here to share some thoughts on inflation and where things need to go. Right back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1859. That was the day John Brown was hanged in Charlestown, Virginia, in what is now West Virginia. He had been sentenced to death on charges of treason, murder, and insurrection for his role in the raid on the United States Federal Armory at Harper's Ferry. Brown and 21 abolitionists intended to seize the arsenal there, then build a free settlement in the Appalachian Mountains. From there, abolitionists and free people of color would wage a guerrilla war against the slave labor system throughout the South. Convicted on November 2nd, Brown resisted plans for rescue and prepared to die a martyr. And on this day, John Brown wrote his last statement. "I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood. I had, as I now think, vainly flattered myself that without very much bloodshed, it might be done." He was marched out of the Jefferson County Jail through a crowd of onlookers that included Stonewall Jackson and John Wilkes Booth to the gallows where he was hanged. While many abolitionists distanced themselves from his actions, they defended him and memorialized him after his death. Frederick Douglass remarked many years later, "His zeal in the cause of my race was far greater than mine. It was as the burning sun to my taper light. Mine was bounded by time. His stretched away to the boundless shores of eternity. I could live for the slave, but he could die for him."
Oh, John Brown's body lies molding in the grave. I'll weep the sons of bondage whom he ventured out to save. And though he lost his life in his struggle to free the slaves, his truth is marching on.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
John Brown's body lies molding in the grave.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So all we keep hearing from the right is, "Oh my God, Joe Biden's responsible for all of the inflation. It's all Joe's fault." You see a new report out that 45%, they're saying, Washington Post, 45% of households are being hurt by increased prices. They're saying that more Republicans are being hurt than Democrats. About 1 in 10 say that the hardship is affecting their standard of living. 35% say it's a moderate hardship. But you listen to the right, the sky is falling. It's the end of civilization as we know it. And yet still want to do something like hold us hostage over the debt ceiling because somehow, yeah, that'll make it better. I'm here to share some thoughts on where we are inflation-wise, where things may go, and if the Fed's going to pull the plug and slam the brakes on. That's why I've asked Mateus Vernengo to come talk with us. Mateus is an economics professor at Bucknell University, one of my go-to guys. Mateus, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you for having me, Rick.
So I'm looking at the reports here. Inflation's horrible. It's the end of the world. Everyone's going to die. It's all over, Mateus. It's the end of the world.
So inflation is higher. It's the highest, the numbers of, the last numbers that I saw earlier this month, it's the highest since 2005 when the price of commodities were going up. Obviously, the price of gas has affected, everybody, so it's visible. But the issues that are important to discuss, so I think there are a couple of things to bear in mind when we think about this. And we have discussed this issue because it has been an issue for a while in previous shows. But one is I don't think that inflation was first of all caused by the programs of this, or even, not that I have much positive to say about Trump, but it wasn't caused by the fiscal sort of packages during the pandemic.
So the spending that they did to get us through, you don't think that has anything to do with it?
Oh, no, it's not that I think. It's a fact. So, I mean, there is some fiction out there, but, inflation has not been caused by excess demand. So the notion that the fiscal packages caused inflation, be that the first three, that all of the Trump packages passed with Democratic votes, and I must say that the Biden packages, the first one passed with no Republican vote, and the infrastructure one had some Republican votes, very few, but it had some, and the Build Back Better had not. So, and we'll see what will eventually pass. But, at any rate, in order to have a fiscal policy being the cause of inflation, you have to have that the economy is at full employment. And because you're hitting the limits of the economy, you're pushing prices up. There is no more stuff to be, and so prices go up. At this point, it will take us with the growing, and the growing is, it's a good recovery. We're recovering from a crisis that was humongous, that's still not over, that we still have Omicron, and, we may have further shutdowns, and God knows exactly what, will happen in the supply chain. But, at this pace of recovery, if we keep having whatever 500 tomorrow, we have a report. So if we tomorrow is Friday, isn't it? Yes. So we get a report. Say it's 500,000 jobs or something like that. So then we keep a good pace of recovery in the labor market. It will take us to 2020, the end of 2022, to get the same level of employment we had at the beginning of the pandemic. So we're not out of the recession, despite of what people say. I mean the recession for me ends when there are more people having jobs than before the crisis. That's the end of a recession, not when whatever output or the asset, the stock market goes up or anything like that. So we're not close to full employment. It's not that, we had hit the limit because we're overspending and people are, doing really well. It's because there are minor supply chain effects that have, affected some prices, and because there are snags in certain commodity prices that are central energy prices. Energy prices are the ones that grew up. So is inflation a concern? Yes. Why? Not because inflation is a terrible thing that it's the dragon that we have. I mean, unemployment is the problem. Poverty is the problem. Inflation, if wages were growing faster than prices, for the vast majority of people, it wouldn't be a concern. The problem is that over the last year, wages have grown slightly less than prices. And so that's the issue. It's hurting people. And I think that there is some, I was listening to what you were saying, there is some concern that Republicans are happy with that because electorally that would be a good thing. And so that's the reason why inflation has become sort of an issue. And I am, I should say, I'm not completely sure that, so there is a whole discussion even within the Democratic Party if Biden should have reappointed Jerome Powell or should have gotten Lyle Brainard, and I tend to think that it's indifferent. I mean, I don't think that the Fed and Powell caused inflation, and I don't think that they will do significant different things. I don't think that if they try to stop the economy a little bit, I don't think that they will be able to do it for a long while. I think that they'll be forced to continue the policies in which monetary policy is relatively loose, and in which they help Treasury maintaining interest rates low to fund the fiscal expansion. I think all of those things will be needed because the economy is not out of the woods.
Right.
And I should say the other thing that it's important because it's being used, as you said, politically, is that build that better. So the further part of the fiscal package that, I'm still hoping we can pass, and it's not going to be close to the size it should be, but, we should pass something. That wouldn't cause inflation. Like the infrastructure plan, it's something that would increase our capacity to produce things. And exactly because of that, it will move further away the limit of the economy that if you hit, you get inflation. So fiscal policy, if done right, actually reduces the chances of inflation rather than increasing the chances of inflation. So I listened to
one of the right-wing talking heads today and said he was going on about how all this government spending is causing all this inflation. It's giving people the ability to stay home and not work. It was just all bad all the time, all horrible. So what people are hearing is that by us spending money, investing in roads and bridges and helping people with the Build Back Better stuff, what they're thinking and what they're being told is this investment is causing inflation. Inflation is bad. It's bad. I can't buy the stuff I want. So we got to stop all of it, which is really short-sighted and dangerous in my view.
It is. It is. And the other important part of this. So there is, as you said, an issue of the message and the media and what they unrelentlessly will sort of push. So this idea that that inflation is normally bad for the working class. So if we had the ability to push wages further up, again, this wouldn't be an issue. So part of the problem actually belies the whole notion that we are, you know, in you know, a situation that it's close to, you know, the high inflation of the 70s. It's that it has been very difficult for workers to even, you know, with all of the difficulties that people are talking about, you know, hiring workers and whatnot, it has been very difficult for, you know, workers to bargain higher wages. And so wages have not grown fast. We cannot even pass an increase in the minimum wage legislation. And so we're still, you know, so this is definitely, I mean, I do hope that we actually get a little bit of good inflation, meaning if we do pass Build Back Better and we do get better conditions for workers and the pandemic does create conditions in which workers have more bargaining power and don't need to go back to jobs that are absolutely, you know, insecure and you know, poorly paid and so on and so forth, then there'll be some wage resistance like in the 70s that, given this supply side sort of, you know, we don't have chips and, you know, because of particular issues during the pandemic or the price of gas, you know, for reasons that have nothing to do with American policy went up, you know, then we may get some wage resistance, but that would be good, you know, so that would be a thing that, you know, again, we would have the equivalent of the 70s in that respect. But I don't think we're there. So I'm sorry to say that I don't think we're there. So inflation will not be the issue. The issue that is still facing us in the foreseeable future is how we get to, again, grow at levels that are, you know, more significant with the, I mean, growing is not the whole thing. It's growing with incorporation of better conditions of work and better pay for workers. And in the current circumstances, I should say, it also implies, given all the effects of climate change and this, that, and the other that we have had, and we know, you know, floods in the areas we are, you know, fires up in the West and so on and so forth, that we get also more spending in infrastructure to avoid all of the sort of also issues that come with that. So,
you're listening to the Rick Smith Show. So, we're here with Mateus Vernango, professor of economics at Bucknell University, talking about inflation and some of the nonsense that we keep hearing on the right about how bad it is. If you got a question, thought for Mateus, give us a call, 866-416-RICK. That's 866-416-7425. Now, a second ago, you said that there's good inflation. You know, we've been trained kind of like Pavlovian dogs that whenever we hear the word inflation, Mateus, we start foaming at the mouth because it's all bad. It means higher prices and we're not going to be able to buy our hamburgers cheap and we're not going to be able to get things cheaply. It means bad. That's what we've been trained. It is what we've been trained.
Well, the point is, you know, there is something that it's important to understand. The obsession with inflation and central banks obsessed with inflation comes from relatively wealthy people. So the wealthy people that depend on real remuneration on their assets don't particularly like inflation. Workers, provided wages go up further than prices, they don't necessarily lose. And so if the interest rates are low, and that's the real issue here. So what gets to Wall Street and wealthy individuals and conservatives is that, you know, interest rates are low. Interest rates being low with a little bit higher inflation means that real remuneration for several assets are sort of smaller. Of course, there is a bubble in the stock market, and that's how, you know, a lot of the money has been done by the very wealthy people. But in general, I mean, the obsession with inflation comes from the conservative camp and not from workers. So I think that there is a messaging problem, and there is an issue also that over the last 40 years, you know, the working class has been weaker, less unions, less ability to protect itself from inflation. And so that obviously is an issue. Yeah. So no, I'm not saying that you should not be concerned with inflation. Right. But what I'm saying is I would like to have the kind of inflation we had in the 70s, in the sense that I would not the high levels. Look at what I'm saying. I'm saying that wages are the cause, you know, to some extent. The demands of workers require that, you know, that prices have to be a little bit higher.
No, I go back to my grandparents who lived the mass of their work life. It was the 60s and 70s. And my grandfather, his union contract, you know, every time inflation went above a certain percentage, he got a raise so that his wages didn't fall behind. And that, you know, we don't have that stopgap, that safety net that generation had to make it through that high inflation, which is why you can say, look, it is hurting the working class because of higher wages, because they don't, or because of higher prices, because they don't have the ability to demand those wage increases like our grandparents did.
If Republicans were so concerned with inflation, they would vote everybody massively to increase minimum wages to a level that makes sense. $15, let me say this, $15 per month, per hour, at this point, given all that happened, it's not enough. We should be talking $20, $21 per, you know, that should be the national minimum wage. And say, oh, we cannot afford it. Of course we can afford it. It's absurd. The notion that we cannot afford it, it's senseless. So there is no problem with that. It wouldn't be inflationary, and also it wouldn't cause unemployment. So all of those are myths that it would cause more people with money, an ability of the economy to grow. It would cause an increase in productivity. So a lot of the higher spending in, if you spend well, if you spend in infrastructure, if you spend in giving better conditions of for work for people, a better welfare system, all of those things go into higher productivity. People that are have good health, that have childcare, that have all of these sort of benefits, they work better. They're better at what they do. They have education. Better at what you do means lower cost of production. So even though you have higher wages, you can pay at the end less, and that's not fiction, that's in the data. So that's the issue. Spending well money and expanding the economy and having higher wages would lead to less inflation. The period in which we had, which is the golden age of capitalism, as it's called, the 50s and 60s, and that starts to break down with the conservative revolution in the 70s, it's a period exactly of high wage growth, which wages going up with productivity. So there was no inflation. There was no inflation because the increases in wages were hand in hand with increases in productivity. And so that's what we had. That's the model we want to go back to.
Yeah, and this is where I keep coming. There's a moment here where we can reset our economy to reward work, which we haven't done in a very long time, and to have a sane, rational tax code that says, the wider your shoulders, the stronger you are, the more water you carry back to the cave, the more you need to do.
Yeah, well, I think the issues of why we this is as the important thing here is that this is a political issue. I don't think it's an economic issue per se. So I don't think that it's because we don't understand the reasons of what's going on. The question is political. The question, I'm sorry to say, is it's not just that the Republican Party has acted in ways that are irrational in many ways, including the sort of populist discourse within the Republican Party. So there is a lot of working class people that vote for the Republican Party, and that's sort of scary and frightening. But it's the result of 40 years of deindustrialization and abandoning of the working class. But divisions within the Democratic Party too. So the fact that we cannot agree on passing a very robust, build back better sort of package, it's part of the problem, I think. So unless we do that, we're going to have trouble next year.
Last question, real quick. Does the inflation? When do you see the inflation kind of tapping down?
Well, here's the thing. When do we see the pandemic passing? I wrote a paper a year ago that was published around December. And one of the things I said, this was before the vaccines were out. I said, if we had vaccines, the vaccines probably will be closer to not because I knew, I was reading what people in that field say, they will be closer to flu vaccines. So you'll end up needing boosters and shots every year. And this will lead to, we will have several other. So it may take a while. And if it takes a while, the inflation thing will stay with us for a while. So we will need these policies for a while.
Good stuff. Mateus, I appreciate the time. Always great stuff, my friend.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Good stuff. Our good friend, Mateus Vernango. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history,
The year was 2001. That was the day that energy trading giant Enron filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. It was the biggest bankruptcy in U.S. history up to that time. At its peak, the Houston-based Enron was the seventh largest company in the country. A combination of mismanagement and all-out greed sank Enron. The company used numerous accounting tricks and loopholes to hide billions of dollars of debt from its shareholders. In August of 2000, shares of the company were worth $90.75. But by November 30th, 2001, they had plummeted to just 26 cents. After filing bankruptcy, thousands of Enron employees were left to go down with the ship. Many employees and retirees had thousands of dollars worth of Enron stock. Employees were told the company would recover. They were encouraged not to sell off their stock and even to buy more, while at the same time, top executives were dumping their stock holdings. When the company went under, the employees' retirement accounts were wiped out. Some who had already retired had to re-enter the workforce. The following January, a New York Times report shared the stories of some of the 4,000 employees laid off in the immediate aftermath of the bankruptcy. One was told he lost his job by voicemail. Another was told he had 30 minutes to clear out his desk. Multiple lawsuits won a portion of the money back for Enron stockholders, but the employees lost more than $2 billion in retirement funds. In the end, more than 20 top executives were found guilty for the crimes they committed while running the company. Enron became synonymous with the corporate greed that has been the hallmark of 21st century America. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday we talked a little bit about the National Labor Relations Board, the general counsel. That's Jennifer Abruzzo, I think is how you pronounce her name. But she came out with a couple of tweets that I said, you know, this is what we need. Someone in that position who understands that workers have the right to strike and employers shouldn't have the right to replace them permanently. It's not the intent of the law, as I've read. It's not the intent of the law, as a lot of my labor lawyer friends have read. But sadly, through bad decision after bad decision, it's where we are. So when an employer like Kellogg's, you know, threatens, hey, you know, we're going to start permanently replacing people. Take it at face. When St. Vincent's Hospital up in Worcester, Mass. Says, sorry, we're not going to let all of your people come back because we're keeping some of the scabs. That's a problem. And here to share some thoughts on, well, on the general counsel's thoughts on maybe if it's possible for us to get back to a place where strikes are actually, a right. I've asked our good friend Sean Richmond to come talk with us. Sean's a contributing writer over at In These Times. He's also the author of Tell the Bosses We're Coming, a new action plan for workers in the 21st century. Sean, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me back.
So did you, I'm sure you saw the tweets by the general counsel. I think everyone in labor circles saw it because it's a great sign, isn't it?
It's a very encouraging sign. Yes. And yeah, there are already memes about this. It's like, oh, when the general counsel starts a tweet thread with the National Labor Relations Act says this and has the little tweet like emoji. It's like, this is going to get good. It's an open invitation for unions to turn back this really terrible Supreme Court decision from 1938 that has never really been properly reevaluated, questioned, whatever, was weaponized by the vast right-wing movement of corporations and the Reagan-Bush administration in 1983 at Phelps Dodge. And really turn strikes into a scary word for a lot of workers because it turns strikes into a thing that can cause you to lose your job when the plain language of the National Labor Relations Act, as the general counsel is saying, says strikes are protected. This act is meant to protect your right to strike. You're allowed to go on strike, but somehow these very ill-considered court decisions and other actions by corporations turn the tables on unions very effectively. In the Reagan-Bush era and continuing into the 21st century.
Yeah, I mean, they spend a lot of money on it. Now, yesterday when I saw the tweets come out, you know, my mind goes, well, why now? Why? What brought this out? And then I remembered you had written a piece back in October kind of laying this argument out. How much of it do you think was your doing, or was it just, you know, it was time?
It was time. It was time.
Now I'm going to give you credit for it because you deserve it.
But it was time. I mean, what I like to do, what I try to do is say, like, guys, this thing, why aren't we doing this? And you know, the history here is frustrating in a lot of ways, right? So, you know, it's a bad Supreme Court decision from 1938. For the most part, it just lays dormant because most employers would not permanently replace their workers who go on strike. It was beyond the pale. And it was only when Phelps Dodge dared their copper mining employees out on strike over draconian cuts in health benefits, pension pay, whatever else, and then immediately bust in thousands of scabs, and then waited them out for a year so that the scabs could then decertify the union. That created the template, the blueprint for this is how you bust a union.
Right.
And it went like wildfire throughout all those years. And so when Bill Clinton comes into office in 1993, the AFL-CIO's top legislative goal is to end the use of permanent replacements by amending the National Labor Relations Act. And it gets stymied by what was then a rare filibuster.
Bob Dole.
Although the beginning of filibusters becoming the norm. Clinton tried some executive action on it, and he got overturned by the courts. And, you know, what labor didn't do back in 1993 is to say, you know, how about we just make the NLRB do its job? Because the plain language of the McKay decision says that you know, okay, fine, if it's necessary for an employer to protect and continue his business, then he can hire permanent replacements, but he can't have union busting as his main goal. And so there's two components to that, right? Like, we all know that a union that goes on strike over ULPs generally is protected from permanent replacements, but ULP is a fairly high standard, whereas wanting to get rid of your union is a lot more plainly obvious, right? You know, Phelps Dodge bargaining their workers to impasse over the pension and the health benefits was legal. They didn't break the law in terms of the way they bargained, but they very clearly wanted to get rid of the union. And we can all point to other examples of this. You know, the Comcast workers in New York City, the cable company, where a new employer comes in, they buy the company, and they like, no more pension, no more this benefit, no more that. You clearly want to get rid of the union. So that's anti-unanimous, which there's almost no case where an employer does hire permanent replacement scabs where they're not looking to get rid of the union. But the other component, and this is in the plain language of the McKay decision, is if it's necessary to protect and continue your business. So over at St. Vincent's in Massachusetts, where the employer has agreed to all of the strikers' economic demands, they can afford the contract. They just want to punish the strikers, yep, and keep some of the permanent replacement scabs on. Okay, why is that necessary to protect and continue your business? How would you go out of business? Like, you're not out of workers. The scabs go on a rehire list. The strikers come back. Where's your economic interest here? So this general counsel is finally getting back to something that the labor movement should have demanded back in 1993. And I think we didn't because we were, I was 14 years old. We were slightly, you know, we took a jaundiced view of the NLRB, viewed it as sort of a broken system. Reagan and Bush had totally broken it. We had no faith in it. And our faith was in legislation. And we went to Congress expecting, like, this is a reasonable minor fix, you know, this accidental Supreme Court decision, the right wingers blew a hole in it the size of a Mack truck, let's fix it. And that was like one of our first tastes of the fix is really in here.
Yeah.
You know, the Republicans and
No, you're right. And it goes back to Reagan and the push for the Republicans and this, you know, the Reagan Democrats and all of this rebuilding of the Republican Party into one that is vehemently anti-union. Because I remember, and I'm not much older than you, I remember there being pro-union Republicans. And you could barely find one now, but they existed in the past. I know it's hard to believe, but they did.
There might be one on Staten Island. Yeah. I read a lot of books about every 5 to 10 years. There are folks in my world in labor education circles and think tanks pull together these edited, you know, collections of essays and research studies, and it's like, here's what it's going to take to restore the labor movement. I've got like 20 of them on my shelf here. And what labor is really bad at is we jump on one thing where we're like, that's it. And then we forget the other 19 really good ideas.
Right.
And so in 1993, like the that's it was, we're gonna get a legislative amendment to the National Labor Relations Act to you know, prevent employers from hiring permanent replacements, right? Flash forward, you know, a decade later, and now it's EFCA, and oh, card check is the main solution. And like, we just forget, like, this. What Abruzzo is trying to do is, you know, she's trying to adhere to a stricter interpretation of the McKay decision. You know, she's not going to overturn McKay. She can't. It's a Supreme Court decision. But the strict reading of it is you can only hire permanent replacements if it is economically necessary to protect and continue your business, and your ultimate goal is not to break the union.
Right.
Find me an employer where that's the case. Find me one. It's definitely not Kellogg's. It's definitely not St. Vincent's.
So this is where her next tweet comes out. She says, in a recent memo, G.C. Abruzzo said she'll examine whether a change is necessary to the permanent replacement doctrine to fulfill the mission of the act. Thus, if a charge is filed involving this issue, she'll consider whether it's appropriate to ask the NLRB to reconsider the law. This sounds to me kind of like a, hey, if anybody's out there listening, bring me something.
I know. No, I mean, like, I think I ended my piece in these times. I'm like, please, for the love of God, file the ULP. And like, there's a bunch of us on Twitter, including, you know, your I think used to work for you, Banditelli, you know, file the ULP. It's like almost a hashtag at this point. Like, just file the ULP. Do it. They're begging for it. They're going to take it seriously. Make the case. St. Vincent's and Kellogg's are the best test cases at this point for that. They should file those ULPs and like, let's see where it goes. And, you know, I've already, you know, I'm already hearing some of the sort of the unintended consequences. Like, if it goes to, you know, if the NLRB goes to a stricter McKay standard, then the bosses are going to take this to the courts. And then we're dealing with the, you know, Trump's federal courts. And we're dealing with a McKay that has the appearance of stare decisis. And, you know, the worries here, and it's almost like a boogeyman worry, is could we get a worse decision out of the Supreme Court? And I'm just like, what would be worse?
Exactly.
We already don't have the right to strike.
Exactly.
What are they going to do to us at this point?
I'm right there with you. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Sean Richmond. He's a contributing editor over at In These Times. He's also the author of Tell the Bosses We're Coming, a new action plan for workers in the 21st century. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at that. If you got a question, comment, something for Sean, quick, you can jump in. 1-866-416-RICK, 1-866-416-7425. Now, here, I want to change gears a little bit. Today, Major League Baseball locked out their players and their workers. And the first story I read over at yahoo.com was, it's a work stoppage. And I know this is just kind of, you know, semantics, but it's not a work stoppage. The billionaire owners threw the people out to the curb.
Well, it says how disappointed I am in my own New York Mets that this is actually news to me. This is how much attention I'm paying to baseball. But yeah, no, you might have seen this like clip of this New Orleans TV station when workers at some delivery company in New Orleans went on strike at dawn. And this like cubby reporter shows up and like, she's like, and they call themselves the Teamsters, and they're out here, they're protesting for their rights, and they say this isn't fair. It's like she has no, like, there's no vocabulary left for most reporters, which is true. Although on the flip side of it is, like, we're really blessed by a number of mostly print or digital reporters who have organized their own newsrooms, and now they know it. And suddenly we have this great crop of some of the best labor reporters that we've had since Abe Raskin croaked, that they understand it at a deeper level. But, you know, I can tell you from experience, it's not taught in J school. I mean, no. my minor at Queens College.
It's one of those things. I guess it's just a little pet peeve. But, you know, to go back to, you know, you had said a bit ago that, you know, employers, you know, didn't fire their workers. They didn't take advantage of in the past. Could it be that the community wouldn't have allowed it? Could it be that, you know, the company would have reacted differently? Because, you know, I had someone tell me back when I was a kid, it's one of those, when I was a kid, he's a little bit older than me, he said you couldn't trip over someone and not hit a union member. Because, you know, union density back in the 70s was, what, somewhere in the 28-30% range. In the 60s, it was as high as 40%. Even when I started working, it was over 25%. So, you know, the culture was everyone knew somebody who was in a union, and you didn't want that guy to lose their job. And also you wanted them to do well because you probably did better too. I mean, I can tell you stories of management coming out to us in negotiation going, get a good deal, because whatever you get, we're going to get too. That's how things used to work.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely the case, right? And so it's partly in the 1970s, you know, with stagflation, folks were feeling a pinch. Union density was just starting to decline throughout the 1970s. And so the spillover effect of, you know, GM wins something, and if GM wins a 3% raise, you were going to tend to get at least a 2% raise, even if you had nothing to do with auto. That was starting to decline. You had much more critical coverage of unions within the media, and not just like news media, even just like pop culture media, right? Like you and I could both sort of list off a bunch of movies in the 70s where, you know, just the general sort of frustration with management was also loaded up with the frustration of the unions. It just felt like the bureaucracy and people weren't with us. And then, you know, Phelps Dodge, 1982, 1983, right? That neatly lines up with Paul Volcker's shock to the system to deal with inflation. Of just like, we're going to ramp up unemployment, we're going to reduce the power of workers so that wages stop going up. That's what made it so that Phelps Dodge could bus in, you know, 1,000 scabs who were willing to, you know, cross state lines, get put up in a hotel, face those ugly picket lines, and take those jobs away from those workers. Things got incredibly ugly there. And that's what made the permanent replacement strategy work. What's interesting about this moment, obviously, is that I will not call what's happening right now a strike wave. Strikes are back in a very real way, and that's very heartening. And strikes are back because workers are feeling a bit of their own power. You know, they know that bosses have to compete over them. And they're much more willing to say, this is not good enough. You know, you got to give us a raise, or I'm out of here. I'm going to quit. If I'm non-union, I'm going to go on strike. If I'm union, and that is some of the noise that I think is adding to the general counsel's tweet storm the other day. You know, and also I'm sure there are conversations that are taking place, right? And I'm sure that there are folks at the international unions. And at the law firms in DC who spent most of their careers probably thinking that strikes scare workers and we can't talk about strikes. They're suddenly feeling like, oh, wait, workers are ready to go on strike again. And we need to protect that because that's how we win.
That is how we win. Sean, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff, my friend. Good stuff. Our good friend Sean Richmond. Make sure you check out his book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. We'll get links out on social media. Quick break, right back. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2009. That was the day that Walmart agreed to pay $40 million to over 87,000 current and former employees in Massachusetts. This was the largest class action settlement in the state's history. The lawsuit, filed in 2001, accused the retail giant of denying workers rest and meal breaks. The company also allegedly refused to pay overtime, manipulated time cards, and required workers to work off the clock for free. In other words, Walmart was accused of wide-scale wage theft. The retail giant decided to settle the case rather than take it to trial. That was not too surprising, since the company had already settled 63 similar federal and state class action wage and hour lawsuits. The total tally Walmart paid out due to wage theft was a whopping $900 million. Under the terms of the Massachusetts agreement, any person who worked for Walmart from August 1995 to the settlement date received a payment between $400 and $2,500. The company was also required to put measures in place to ensure that wage theft stopped. This included a hotline that workers could call anonymously if they were made to skip meal breaks. Walmart also agreed to use a clock-out lockout program that prevents workers from using store cash registers if they are not actually clocked in for work. In an affidavit filed with the settlement, the lead counsel for the employees said the accord dwarfs settlements of similar class actions against Walmart across the country. Not surprisingly, the company has strenuously resisted all efforts by its store employees to join and form unions. Wage theft, not getting paid for all of the hours you actually work, continues to be a major complaint of low-wage workers and is an important issue for today's labor movement. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
With Chime's secure credit card, you can start improving your credit scores with everyday purchases and regular on-time payments. Get started at chime.com/build. The Chime Credit Builder Visa credit card is issued by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A., members FDIC. Results may vary. See chime.com for details. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.